All right, why don't you just start out, give me your names and spell them so that when the secretary transcribes this, she gets the spellings
right.
Yeah,
my name's Jim Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T.
All right.
And
my name is Orrin Conklin, O-R-A-N-C-O-N-K-L-I-N.
O-R-A-N? Okay, because Frank has it written down O-R-I-N.
Yeah,
see, it's a good thing I asked,
right.
Or else your name would get misspelled.
Right.
Okay.
I think I got it spelled in my like record over.
You want to know it? Sure.
Yeah, start, you know, sort of when, you know, where you grew up and when you started working on the docks, when you retired, so we sort of have a general idea of what period you worked in.
Well, myself, I started in as a commercial fisherman years ago and graduated to steamships for 5 years. And went up to Alaska and South America. And when the war came on, I was in Todd Shipyard 5 years and then graduated to longshoring, which I stayed at for 27 years and retired.
Was that after the war you started longshoring?
Yeah, after the war. And in 1960, I was secretary to the Union for a year and served on the flying squad picket duty in 1936 strike.
As a sailor?
As a, yes, I believe I was a Marine fireman at the time.
Oh, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that about does it for me. Of course, I graduated from the hold to the deck, retired as a gang man, gang boss.
Yeah. Jim,
well,
when
I
did
was,
you
start? I had been on the waterfront since 1920, on the West Coast, I will say, since 1928. And when the 34th strike came, I sailed with Tronson before 34. And in 1934, I belonged to Wobblies and Lundberg. Lundberg, of course, was Walton. He and I were great friends, and I was his number right-hand man all during the 34th strike. And I was a liaison officer. I was a liaison between Tacoma and Seattle for the sailors.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I got really well acquainted here, though I knew Tronson before that. And they wanted me to come offshore over here, so I started in extra over here, and then I worked at 34, and I worked some at 35, but I, meantime, I was sailed to Alaska. I'd go out and sail to Alaska. That's where the money was then. And I came back here, went on a water, then went steady on a waterfront until the war came. Well, they told me I'd either have to go in the Army or go back to sea. But they had so much sea time, they had sail steam schooners and everything on the coast. So I went back to sea, and I stayed until, what was it, 1955. And then I came back on the waterfront again. Of course, I had all the credit and everything toward my pension and everything given to me, so I stayed till 1955, and then I went and come back on a waterfront. But I had a master's license, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I sailed to Alaska for months. In the early 30s, and then I sailed after the 34th strike, and then I sailed with the coastline line for years up there. And Dick Lux and I were on opposite ships. He was mate on one ship, and I was mate on the other. And of course, that's where the money was. But so that's it. After all, that's what we needed was money. You know?
Yeah. So
then my wife, my wife was teaching school then. My son was growing up, so I couldn't get back on the waterfront. And I seen most of the strikes and everything on the coast.
Mm-hmm. When did you retire?
I retired in 72. Mm-hmm. He retired the same time.
Under 72, so did you get it in under the M&M? You didn't get
that big severance
bonus.
I didn't want that M&M.
You didn't like that?
As far as I'm concerned, I didn't want that M&M.
Why not?
Nobody that got it come out ahead on a deal. Mm-hmm. We got better pension than they do. Now they're squawking it. Now the whole trouble is, you know, now they're squawking the fellows that took that M&M. They get way over $100 less than we do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They get over $100 a month less than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're squawking it. They think that they should have the same amount that we did, see?
Mm-hmm.
We could have taken that M&M. That M&M wasn't what it was popped up to be, you know. They said $13,000. Well, you didn't get $13,000. You're going to get $9,000. $9,000 something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When Uncle Sam took their share. So it didn't appeal to me, I don't, as far as I was concerned.
Here in Tacoma, did most people wait it out, or did most people take the M&M, people who were eligible?
Well, it was 6-1 half done the other. Some of them took it. Some of them were mad because they couldn't get. But reality, I don't see any of those guys that got it. There's only a few of them that got anything out of it.
Very true.
Most of it went bingo, you know.
thought they were
rich and
spent it too
$13,000 was a drop in the bucket, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They spent it too fast. Now they're all squawking it. Even on the coast down at this convention, they're always squawking down there that the ones that took the $13,000 are always squawking. They think they should be having the same amount as the fellows that turned it down, see?
Mm-hmm.
And when in reality, they lost money by it.
Uh-huh. Do you guys get a cost of living? Do you have a cost of living thing in your pension?
No, there's no cost of living in it, but they, when they renew the contract, then we usually get a raise in pension.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they're going to give us this time, but they say that they're going to take and negotiate the pension first. If they do, that's what they should do. But these young fellows on the waterfront, some of them are against that. And because they're the ones that, where the money comes out, you know, they're the ones that make it. And you see there's as many pensioners on the coast as there are workers. Which makes it kind of tough too, you know.
Yeah.
But we've always got a raise.
Mm-hmm. When the M&M agreement was first proposed in 61, how did the people in Tacoma feel about it?
Well, everybody thought it was a big deal. Everybody thought that was fine. I'd say practically everybody did.
People weren't worried about losing jobs and, you know, cutting down the number of jobs available and stuff?
No, I do nothing worried about that, about losing jobs. In fact, nobody was worried about it. Well, we didn't have many men here then either, see. The workforce was way smaller than what it is now. And nobody lost any jobs over the thing. Everybody was working the same.
We had reduced manpower because of
changing gang sizes.
Yeah,
and
that's right, gang size and everything. But when it, overall, everybody was working just about the same as they did before. There wasn't an awful lot of. I don't think any jobs were lost.
No, our port was in a great move of enlarging, you know, and growing. So we were.
They absorbed everybody.
They absorbed everybody. We didn't have any problems.
No.
Were there any problems when, you know, when they reduced gang sizes and took off, you know, minimum load limits and stuff, or maximum load limits and stuff? Was there any problem with speed up with the employers pushing guys to work faster?
Well,
yes and no.
Yes and no, that's right. you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And most of the foremen were from here and belonged to them. And they were kind of reticent about taking in and forcing anybody. Well, it wound up when they tried to do the forcing, then they began slowing down. So then a minute just kind of humped it back up a little bit and just slowed down a little bit. Especially when they try to stretch the day to get the ship loaded in 10 hours, you know, on the penalty. Well, pretty much all depended on who was walking and what company it was and everything else. So.
Were there any one of the companies that tried harder than the others to push people? Seemed to have a policy of trying to force
rest
them?
Rest assured it was Rothschild, if it was any of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Rothschild was amazing.
Have they always had a reputation for being like
that's
that?
Right. They've always had a reputation for being that way.
How about when Tiny was working for him?
Same way.
Same way.
Tiny was no different. He was working for Rothschild. Because I was checking them most of the time,
yeah.
A lot of years. And they try to pull all kinds of shenanigans, you know, and everything else. But they weren't able to get by with it too much. They were. And Tiny, of course, when they pulled a shenanigan, when I tried to, he'd come down. And of course, he'd holler, but he knew in his. Inside of him, he knew, you know, that he wasn't going to get away with it. So.
But yeah, I was curious because, I mean, given that he'd spent so many years in the union,
right.
And been, you know, an
right.
official and everything
right.
else, I'd wonder how his attitude might have been different than some of the other people, the other companies.
Well, it's like that with every other job. You working for a person, you work their style, or you don't work for them.
Mm-hmm.
You either do what they want you to do, or you. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like it, you quit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it goes. As long as you're, of course, Tiny was looking out for Tiny too. He had to have. He's making good money, and after all, you gotta take all that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blaming him. I was in the same position. I know what he was up against.
Was there ever any resentment among the men because, you know, well, Tiny should be a union man, he should be on our side?
No. He every chance he got, he would take it. And agree with the union. He'd agree with the union, but Tiny's a very smart individual, you know, too.
He was also on the other side of the fence, and he had how to do it
that's
their
correct.
Way. Just the same as you're writing the book, you know, same thing. You're going
that's the
through.
Same thing when I was sailing. I raised up with in a sailor's union. Well, most of the fellows that come on board and worked for me, we knew each other. And I just had to tell them, well, here's the way it is. And as long as we go this way, wait. Everything's fine. I know where I had to come. Of course, I'm going to go to sail to Alaska. They were making big money in those days. They were making $1,200 a month. Well, I always told them, I have the pencil. If you don't do it my way, that's fine with me. I got the pencil. And I could give or I could take. And I never had anybody squawk about taking anything from them. They all wound up with more than they had coming them. Well, different on the ship, on the Alaska ships, right? The sailors were working cargo all the time, you know. And they had a tough agreement. And I wasn't supposed to give them days off or anything else. And they come into port, I wasn't supposed to give them days off. They were all supposed to be there working. But they knew I could if I wanted to, if I felt like it, I'd give them the time. But you see, a lot of the crew, most of the crew is made up between Portland and Seattle. So some of them went off in Seattle, they couldn't let them all off at the same time. Then they squawk and holler, but what the devil, you can't do anything. It's just the same position time.
Yeah, or shift ship once in a while too, you know.
That's right.
Sure.
Now, what about in 58 when Tacoma finally went into the ILWU? What was the discussion like? I mean, who were the people who, you know, were pushing the hardest to join the ILWU, and who were the people who didn't want to go at all? Who, you know, how did it line up, and how did the discussion go?
Sellers was one of them. Fred Sellers.
And
Foxy Smith.
And what's his name from the old town, you know, Casey?
Ward?
Well, Sherman.
Sherman
Casey.
Sherman.
Of course, they were against it. They were squawking and everything against it, but they sold that bill of goods. So they started for it. I never did care for bridges. I'd known bridges as long as any man in this waterfront. And I never did care for him. He and Romaine Balky and some of the fellows I've known them ever since before they ever belonged to the Union either. And they hated me, and I didn't give any quarter.
Mm-hmm. What was it you didn't like about him?
Well, be truthful with you, I never went to the Communist Party on this coast. Romaine Balky, young communist, belonged to young communists, and in fact, owns one of the headmen. And no one will ever tell me that Bridges didn't belong, although in court they proved that he said he wasn't, but no one will ever tell me that I've been around him too much.
There's one we don't fit something that's liable.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, your opinion is your opinion.
That's
you can't
my
be
opinion.
Charged for libel if you're just stating it's your opinion.
Yeah, right. Oh, I see.
That's been my opinion, and everybody knows it. So even Harry knows it. He just looks at
me. Well, I think Harry knows almost everybody's opinion was that he was in the CP, but
he just looks at me.
If you can't prove it, you can't prove it. You just have to go on what you got. So.
That's right. What you?
Tiny said that there were maybe about five guys in the local here, like in the 30s, that people thought might be in the CP, but no one was ever able to really prove it.
That's right.
Do you have any feelings
about
that?
Yeah, just about five. Just about five. That's correct. I know.
And they tended to be the same five guys who always wanted this, would speak for the CIO in favor of the CIO.
That's right. Same man. Same five men. Then they got the wards. So, of course, Sherm, he was loud about, so was Casey. Mm-hmm. They get up and holler and holler. And when they changed over away, a lot of their friends didn't care for them too much anymore.
Why do you think they finally decided to go into the ILWU? I mean, one of the things I've gotten is that the pension fund, the ILA's pension fund was in a lot of trouble, and people were fearful of losing it.
That's correct.
That's correct.
And the only one that didn't go in was Port Anzus. Port Anzus stayed out. Bunch of nice guys up there, too. I knew, well, a whole bunch of them. They wouldn't go over. They wouldn't turn over. So. And I guess they have now, but they didn't for years. But, well, the pension plan, I'd say it was the main issue for this local board.
And then, of course, from that, you joined the coast, you could travel for any port and work, you know. All you had to do was go before the executive board, and they'd allow you the same privileges the people in that particular port had going for them to get work, and that way you could work a vacation if you wished to, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, in the note days, there wasn't as much work as there is now. When I first came in this local, well, gee, if you made $100 a month, boy, you were doing good, huh?
Right. When I was first in it, you were lucky to average 2.5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can work most every day, you know. Well, it has been ever since World War II, really.
Yeah.
It's been the port is booming in all directions. Look at the docks they've built, you know.
Yeah.
They've built, what is it, 2 or 3 docks since we've retired in 8 years.
Yeah.
Pierce County, for one.
We just came from there, seeing Salters down there, talking to all the fellows that we knew down there. Boy, that's an awful talk.
Was in 58, wasn't it, part of it also is that a lot of the guys who had been around in the 30s and the 40s when the real hostility was going on weren't there anymore, and the younger guys, I mean, they hadn't been through that, so they didn't have this sort of fierce loyalty.
Right.
That's correct.
You know.
That's correct.
So they were more susceptible to sort of practical, you know.
Young fellows had different outlook. And, of course, then, by that time, most of us were old. They called us, they look at you, old man, see. Just like some of these kids down there that we were talking to today. One of them down there has 37 years in on the waterfront, and he's only 52 years old.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
He must have lied about his age when he started.
No. He came on here when he was a kid.
Yeah.
He's got credit for 37 years. He's only 52 years old. But, some of those kids, you know, some of them never finished high school.
Mm-hmm.
And come on a waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say one thing. I don't think the drinking, there's much drinking on the waterfront as it was. These younger fellows aren't slobbed up like that.
You think that's the difference in the men, or is it maybe the employers have been more, you know,
the employer paid no attention. The employer paid no attention to these guys that were drunk.
Yeah.
Men go down on a job drunk and someone else to do work. You've seen it happen.
Oh, sure. But actually,
just like this Tanner, this judge, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Who put him through law school? The longshoreman put him through law school. He used to come down on job, he could take any job on this waterfront. Didn't have to go by earnings or anything. They gave him that privilege when he was going to go to University of Washington. Mm-hmm. He'd get down on a job, go to sleep. That was it. The men did it. document all the rest of it that he's worked for.
Was that a favor done for Ernie?
Right.
To let Jack
work? Yeah, very much so, because Ernie was in the labor movement and in the negotiations, and was down to San Francisco, wasn't he?
Yeah.
To finalize some of our contracts. So this is one reason why they extended him that privilege.
Didn't do us any good, I'll tell you that.
Well, he's, I'm not going to say any more.
Well, my back was hurt. He knows how I feel. But I told him to his face. But that's the way he got his education.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear anybody else tell you the same thing. And he'll tell you the same thing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that, you know, I'm interested in is getting an idea of how the work itself has changed over the years.
Well,
and I've had, you know, some, you know, like Lee and those people talk about, you know, in the 20s and even before that, you know, about what the, you know, it was all handwork and it was hard and people were hurt constantly.
In the
30s
and early 40s. They had the Russian ships coming in, you know. They had, they brought this, from the Baltic, they brought this flag from the smelters over there. Well, this smelter out here was the finest smelter in the world at that time. They bring shiploads of that stuff over here. And they run it through this smelter. And this smelter, they made money out of it, see. And the Russians made money out of it. Because they got copper, gold, and silver out of it, which the Russians couldn't extract gold and silver. And this smelter extracted all the gold and silver out of it. But those ships that come in, you talk about work. Those ships that come in, they were full to the hatch. Each two men had a steel plate, and they threw it down the yard, and they start shoveling in the buckets. And when you finished, the ship was empty. Now that was, that was a lot of back-breaking work. And you'd be on one of those ships for 10, 11 days, maybe. Big payday out. But it was hard work.
When did it start to change where there was less and less handwork and you had more and more machines?
Well, lumber and flour and all general cargo was mostly all handwork. World War II, I think, is when the turning point.
Yeah, World War II they started.
Then they started using four-wheelers in the hatch, and they started using forklifts in the hatch. And then on it developed to a very fine thing. Now they build ships exactly square in the hatches, so.
They build them for mechanized mechanization.
Mm-hmm.
Did
either of you guys get in on any of the container work towards the end? Did you?
Oh, yeah. I checked hundreds of containers I ever heard for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for 2 or 3 years there, the container ships were showing up all the time. They were converting their ships to containers, like American Bay and Lake. They brought up the beautiful new ships and they converted them into containers and stuff.
All American Mail Line ships took a certain amount of containers on deck. They were fitted for that.
Well, in the beginning, the containers were almost only on the decks, weren't they?
That's
and then
right.
there was regular
right.
cargo underneath.
Right.
And
no, they got the whole 2,000 containers.
Yeah.
Some of these ships on the East Coast carried 2,000 containers. Then they got the Ro-Ro ships come in from Australia, you know. Of course, everything went in the stern end and come out by lift. And they were beautiful ships. easy load, easy discharge. Then to begin, then on a, as far as the waterfront is concerned, then you begin to see the younger fellows going to these lift drivers, and lifts and all that stuff, mm-hmm. which the lifts are practically the key.
Sure, you. Yeah.
They're the key to this waterfront right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, they tried everything. They had palletized cargo. They had everything. So finally they went to these vans all together, which had cut down on the pilfer,
mm-hmm.
which was a great
asset, really.
They had lots of money, lots of pilfer. As they think to a cargo guy, well, look what inside of it. Well, he opened up, take a look. He liked it, well, he took a piece. So.
Mm-hmm.
So Tacoma, none of the West Coast has ever really had the pilferage kind of problems they have on the East Coast, though.
No.
And it's always been less.
That's right.
No,
go to New York. Go to New York if you know what you're looking at. Why? Boy, it's terrible. But Tacoma, I will say, Tacoma had less pilferage than any place on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they put out more work. They always have put out more tonnage,
mm-hmm.
and discharge and loading.
Why do you think that is? Why have they always been?
Well, we were highly competitive with Vancouver, BC for a number of years. If we wouldn't handle
and
cargo,
Seattle.
Vancouver and Seattle would. So we automatically built up our own port to compete with any of them.
That's right, they had to.
We had
mm-hmm.
to. To compete, get the work, they had to put out. So
mm-hmm.
they just gradually kept putting out more and more.
Have you always felt that the port, like the port commission and the various you know, managers of the port and stuff have been cooperative? I mean, that they've been willing to see your side?
I believe they have. I've known Smith and several been on the port commission, and they're fellows you could talk to. They come down, most of them come down on the dock, and we always talk to them, you know, and they ask your opinion and everything. And the man I give credit for this port, who I give it, is Perry.
Mm-hmm.
When Perry was here, he's come down there, and talk to us, he's come down there and shoot the breeze. Eli will be there on Saturday, Sunday, or any day. And he showed me a plan that the two of us were standing there talking to him. He showed us, he pulled out this rule, and he showed us this plan of the dock. And I said, Perry, I'll never really see that. It's a fine conception of what the port should be and everything else. I agree. Oh, he said, he might surprise himself. He said, oh, here, by golly, it's all up here.
It's practically all here, and the only portion they got left is that one wall.
Well, the only thing they haven't filled in between 4 and the 2 yet, have they?
No.
No, where the marina is,
where Johnny's dock was?
Yeah.
They took that out. Well, the marina there, that's going out. Because they're going to, the plan showed then that they fill from Pier 4 right over to Pier 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they increase the container space. So.
Pier 1 is going to connect right down to this Sitkom waterway too, where 7 is now located. Isn't that Sitkom?
Yeah,
7's
our
Sitkom,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
But,
In other words, there's going to have docks, great big U like that, clear over to Pierce County.
Those aluminum
domes
over there, they were quite the addition. You ever inside one of those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've unloaded many aluminum.
The man that put those up, a very close friend of mine. He was a steel worker. He was considered the finest steel worker on the Pacific Coast, finest steel man on the Pacific Coast. No engineering degree or anything, but all the big bridge companies and everything were after him. They had a tough job. Why? They always called out. He took a raise that bridge going over the Columbia, you know. He raised that thing, and I said to him, "What are you going to do?" "Oh," he said, "we're going to raise the damn thing up." He said, "Till both bridges are even." I said, "Oh," but they did. And they raised it right up. They raised it up until both bridges down. You go in here for it, and you go across the bridge. Both bridges are absolutely level.
Well, those alumni domes are just as big as a standard baseball field.
Yeah.
You put a baseball diamond right on the inside of them.
That's
they
right.
Can go play.
Just as big as the Seattle.
Right, Kingdome.
They look as big as the Kingdome out there.
They are.
They
huge.
Are.
They're huge.
They are.
But they're prettier. The Kingdome's the
and
biggest
got,
thing
they
I
got
ever saw.
Quite a bit of machinery in there, too. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Loads these cars and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him, "How long will it take you?" He told me exactly how. He said, "Might even get finished a week ahead of time." I said, "No, but he did."
Did anything, the day they finally finished erecting the first big crane, I guess it's over on 7 now, but it was put over on 4
yeah.
the first time,
mm-hmm.
Was there any particular feeling about that? Because it must have been real strange. You'd never seen anything
put
up like that
before. We were all looking forward to it. We watched it. I watched it go up.
Mm-hmm.
We watched it go up piece by piece. Yeah, that was quite a feat, too, building that thing. It was a German crane, I think.
Yeah.
The first one was a German crane. Yeah, they brought it here on North German Lloyd, I think, ship brought it in. Brought the whole darn crane. See, there were enough pieces laying around on that on Pier 4 over there. Some of them would shake our heads. They never get that thing all together, but it all came together. Yeah, that was. You know, the feet, when they moved these cranes around, you know.
I saw them when they moved it from 4 over to 7.
Yeah, they run it on the barges, and of course the tide and everything had to be just right, you know. And everything had to go just according to oil, otherwise they could tip the barge or anything.
Well, I thought they moved that big crane right across on railroad rails.
No, they ended up moving it on a barge.
No, they moved it on a barge.
I know the Washington's all went on barges.
Yeah, that big one went on a barge too.
They just take the cab off and set her down and set the legs on it and run them around.
Nothing to it. Well, you got to know what you're doing.
Oh, sure.
Those guys are barge companies, they knew what they were doing. So.
Well, now, had there been any containers come in before they got the crane up? Had you had any experience with having
containers with the Hurleys and stuff? They had
stuff?
These small cranes first.
Uh-huh.
And they would handle up to 45 tons.
Well, they put, two slings, one around each end? How would they?
They use a bridle.
Each one of those containers have eyes on each corner.
Yeah.
They're built special so that the next container comes in will set right in there.
Right.
They're locked in there. So they use a special bridle on them. These small cranes would pick them up, but some of those containers, we pick one at one of theirs going on the mainline ship here at 4. They started picking up. I said, "Set it down." "What's the matter?" I said, "That damn thing will break in the middle." Loaded and all. But it had 48 ton in it, huh?
Oh.
And all of us said, "We'll pick it up." So we all got clear. they picked it up all right. Well, fins went like that, you know. Dump the whole. It was aluminum. Had the aluminum ingots.
But the box just split down the middle?
Oh, the container split right the middle. They had it loaded too heavy in the middle. They figured, well, they had it stacked higher in the middle than they did in the end. So when they picked it up, of course, the weight didn't pick it up either. Then they had brought these straddle carriers.
Yeah, they were quite an innovation.
Yeah, what were they doing before the strads came along? Were they dropping the cans right on the chassis? The truck would pull under and they'd put it directly on the chassis, or how would they move the cans around?
Well, they had one straddle carrier here before, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had one straddle carrier, so most of them went on here before. And a lot of times trucks would drive right under.
Before that, trucks run right under the crane, right under the gear.
They picked it up right off the truck.
And of course, the truck would back them up against the dock or a platform and unload them. Now they take the strads and run around wherever they want. From one dock to the other.
Oh, they're always going by here. So how's the safety changed over the years? I would think that with more and more of the machinery and the specialized equipment, the job would get safer.
It does. They've had to have more safety regulations. Years ago, when there wasn't safety, all they were worried about was getting the cargo out. One gang would be trying to beat the other gang, get the cargo in and out. It was quite a different setup years ago. Most of the men are gone now.
That's what they are.
Do you remember any of the real serious accidents?
Yes, I've seen a few of them.
Several of them. Engstrom?
Yeah.
What happened there?
They come in with a crane load and jammed him against the bulkhead. Of course, he was told to get out of there and stay out, but he wouldn't. You know.
Well, some men were, you know, people had different temperaments. He's highly nervous type. They're always jumping around someplace. Then there's ones that are calmer, you know. And it was usually the ones that were high strung and everything, and were jumping around. They were the ones that got hurt. Mm-hmm. But they jumped to where they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And of course, some of the accidents were really accidents where it couldn't be helped, but it was where a man slipped or the gear let go or something like that, you know. There's been a lot of men killed, hurt badly on this one.
Well, everybody can see
that. I can wrap on wood.
Right.
Never got hurt with a bat up.
Everybody can see how accidents happen after they happen.
Yeah.
Have they ever lost any cans? Have they ever dropped any cans and hurt anyone? The containers?
Well, no. I not that I know of. They might have, but dropped a few of them, all right. Which was bound to happen. Any line of business, you're bound to have an accident sooner or later.
One of the first ones was a fellow by the name of Laura, L-A-U-R-A.
Yeah.
And they didn't have big paper rolls. This weighed about 3,300 pounds was on a pallet board. Come in and he stepped off from under the combing right as the load was coming down. Just squashed
him. Put him right down here, went right under his head, kept right on
going. Right. Next one was his son's up in the hall now. Bob, I can't think of his last name. But he got killed with a log.
Oh, that was Reed.
Yeah, Bob Reed. Mm-hmm. Not Bob Reed.
Well, that was a
Frank
fluke.
Reed.
Frank. Yeah, Frank. Bob Reed's up on.
Bob's
but that was a fluke.
Oh, sure.
When he got killed, that was a fluke. Mm-hmm. He slipped. They'd already come back with them. They'd already rolled along. Mm-hmm. And Frank slipped. In fact, I don't think he should have. Frank should have never been down on the job. He had a gang.
Well,
a little money hungry, you know.
He done that to keep himself in shape, really.
Yeah, money hungry, too.
It was in his own gang that happened.
No, it wasn't.
Was it?
No, he took that job in another gang.
Yeah, and everybody heard about Frank Susan, I imagine.
I'm not sure that name's come up yet.
You've got an old log stacker here, right over here at Blair. Doc.
Yeah.
You the...
He stepped right, walked right out in front of it. I have back of my mind, I got more suspicion than what happened. He was a dang peculiar guy anyway. Nice fellow.
Mm-hmm.
But, he'd been out to still, you know, he kind of went off, he was out to still, and then he come out of there and he went back in the waterfront. He was a couple of years there.
Oh, sure, he was a good 2 years back in the waterfront.
Walked in front of one of those logs, stackers, down the road.
Who's been responsible for the improvement in the safety? Has it either the shipping companies and the stevedoring companies?
Oh
been,
yeah,
or
been,
is it
they got signs all over, you know, and they're after safety too. You know. Of course, that costs them too because their insurance goes up, you know.
Well, actually, the federal government has a law,
yeah,
too, to that effect on the waterfront, and every time a certain type of accident happens, well, they try to improve it, you know, like...
But as far as these state engineers, the state guys come down, they don't know what they're doing when they walk on the ship, and they don't know what's safe and what isn't safe.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is probably both the accidents is the gear.
Right.
Gear's not kept up on the ship. You don't keep mm-hmm. the gear up, or it's going to, eventually you're going to go bang, and that's it. But I don't know.
Well, I don't know. We added any to your knowledge?
Well, sure, but one last thing I want to ask you, just your own opinions, is how you think the union has changed over the years, and especially how, you know, if you think that the guys who are in today, you know, the younger people, whether they have a different attitude towards the union than you guys did.
I don't think so. They all know where their bread is buttered on, where their bread and butter comes from. I take my hat off to these kids, a lot of them. They're intellectual. People up there in that hall, there's a hell of a lot of them up there, had to. 1, 2, 3 years of college.
Right.
They got a good head. They got a good head in their shoulder, and they know where their bread's buttered on. And I believe they're all pretty good.
And the majority of them has gone through strikes too. Even in '72, we had a.
Mm-hmm. Even those that haven't, our sons. Our
right.
sons know what happened. They know what happened. I wasn't married when I was 34, 35, 36.
Right? Well, I wasn't either.
I wasn't married then, but after that, those kids, of course, those kids, they took it on the chin too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
When there wasn't any money coming in, they didn't have it so easy either.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that.
Yeah, this port one time was shut down.
Plus, I was kind of in a good position. My wife was a school teacher. I didn't worried one way or the other. But
mm-hmm.
a lot of fellows really, really had it tough.
Yeah, this port one time before World War II was shut down 8.5 months on account of bubonic plague.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
No.
I haven't heard that yet.
Oh, yeah.
Someone on one of the ships that came in had it, and
no, they found an old rat.
Found a rat down Sperry Mill
or Portland Avenue or wherever
someplace.
It was. Had the bubonic plague.
Well, they had. Then they brought in those teams, you know that. You know they. Did you ever see where they had the eight or nine ferrets, and they had the five or six little fox terriers? Dodds Berry Mill, and they stick those, they let those ferrets go. And a rat, he'd run in the hole, the ferret would run right in after him. Well, a ferret would chase him out. But the minute they come out, bingo, one of the little fox terriers would grab him by the neck and shake him like that, his neck would broke, and that was his tail end. Then they put the ferret in another hole. It was really something to see. But for a while there, they had all the rat traps down there at Sperry.
Right.
She and the fellas would be walking along and back on one of the damn rat traps would catch you on the foot. Didn't hurt you too much, but it really startled you, you know.
Yeah.
And on the steps, you know, you're walking up the steps, right, they'd have a rat trap in there, and you'd catch bang, and your rat trap would come down, blacken your toes sometimes.
Well, that they had to shut the whole port down?
They shut everything down here. They sure did. Well, rats have played a part in shipping ever since shipping ever started, as far as that
yeah.
goes. And I don't think there's a shipping company in existence that has fumigated their line of ships.
Oh,
at least once a year, if not twice.
When I was on that South American run, we had to fumigate all the time.
Sure.
And one of those rat men in Pedro, he could come along and he could go down in the hold and pick up the excavation on everything, and he'd tell you almost to the rat and how old the rats were. Mm-hmm. Black man he was. He was really good. But down in Columbia, he'd go up there and you tie up at the dock down there, put the gangway up, the damn rats, they'd come right up the gangway. Big ones, and they had long hair on them like that, like a cat. Yeah, big rats.
Well, they chased all of us off the ship down in Peru one time, fumigated, we stayed ashore 24 hours.
Well, you're loading. All of coffee. A rat will go in a small hole in a coffee sack and stay in there. Then they come up when they're on the ship. But you take a piece of apple and put it in a rat trap. They can't resist.
Mm.
Boy, they'll go after that. They used to bring on this stuff, I forget what they call it, some rat kill and stuff. But you put your finger in the darn thing, it'll have to kill you too. Because it goes in the pores.
Oh, it goes through your skin.
Yeah, it goes through your skin. They had done his ship. After the rat man, he put it out. Come up to me and he began telling me all about it. I said, what? So I took it very politely. Well, got one of the sitters. Explained the whole thing to him, and we very politely picked them all out and threw them overboard. Mm-hmm. After all, actually, sailors working on the ship all the time, they're working on the lifeboats all the time. They stuck their finger in there, they'd probably kill them.
Hmm. Well, thanks for taking the time.
Well,
every story helps, and a lot of times, you know, one guy will tell me something, and if I can check it out with somebody else, then I'll be sure he's telling me the right thing.
You have to go out and see Jacob.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah. He's in